You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Revelation chapter 17, the fall of Babylon, verse 1. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came to me, John, and said, "Come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute, who sits on the many waters." So now we've got another figure being brought into this whole apocalyptic scene. First it was the dragon, and then the beast, and then the second beast who's the false prophet. But now we've got this great prostitute. What is this? Verse 2, "With her, the prostitute, the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries. The angel carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness. I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads and 10 horns. This is review. We've already been over this. Scarlet beast refers to the Antichrist. You're going to have to look back in Revelation chapter 13 for that. The seven heads refers to these seven empires throughout history: Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Media Persia, Greece, Rome, and then future Rome. That's why it mentions 10 horns. Why are there 10 horns? Ancient Rome didn't have that. Even if you go with the long version of Rome, Rome fell in the 5th century. One half of Rome didn't fall until the 1400s. There were never 10 kings on the throne. It's never happened. It'd be like saying there were 3 presidents. Never happened. So, this is going to be Rome in the future, and this woman, this prostitute, is what she's called by John, is sitting on the Antichrist. It's like she's somehow co-mingled with this final world empire. The woman was dressed in purple and in scarlet. These were the colors of royalty of the day. She was glittering with gold, precious stones, and pearls. She held a golden cup in her hand filled with abominable things and the filth of her adulteries." So she is one bad broad, this girl. "The name written on her forehead was a mystery. Babylon the Great was her name, the mother of prostitutes and the abominations of the earth." Babylon the Great. Why is she named Babylon the Great? And who is she? Who is this figure? Of course, it's a symbol. We need to interpret the symbol. What does the symbol mean? Well, the symbol means Babylon the Great. Well, what does Babylon the Great mean? One view holds that this is a literal city. When it refers to Babylon the Great throughout the text, it refers to Babylon as a quote-unquote city. If you look at the nearest context, chapter 16, we said that the Euphrates River was literal. Jerusalem was literal. It was split into 3 parts, was it, in that earthquake? That we said that was literal. So now we get to chapter 17, and now this geographical detail, Babylon, that's figurative. Could be a literal city. Babylon occurs throughout the Old Testament 300 times. Did you know that? Babylon. Once in the Bible, it's used symbolically in 1 Peter 5:13, where Peter says, "I'm writing to you from Babylon." Babylon's in modern-day Iraq. And in Peter's day in the first century, there was nothing there. So Peter wasn't writing from literal Babylon. He was writing from Rome. It's a code name for Rome. So some people say Babylon is Rome, and they get into the 7 hills mentioned later. We've already been through that. That's bogus. There are no 7 hills in Revelation 17. Oros, the word Oros, doesn't mean hill. It means mountain. That's what's referring to there. So it's not Rome. What is it then? Babylon, I would submit to you that Babylon, being used 300 times in the Old Testament, is the literature from which John is drawing this image. He's not drawing it from a single symbolic reference in 1 Peter 5:13. Revelation has 404 verses, and it cites or alludes to the Old Testament somewhere between 250 and 300 times. Yeah, the Old Testament is the library that John is using, not necessarily 1 Peter. And Babylon never faced sudden permanent destruction. I mean, it kind of did back during the first Persian Gulf War. Saddam Hussein was trying to rebuild Babylon and make it into a big city, and all the prophecy nuts were going crazy over that, like it's going to get rebuilt. Never happened. It's still sand. But it never really faced the destruction that we see in Jeremiah 15:51, the end of that book. Okay, another view is that Babylon the Great isn't symbolic for another city, Rome, but it's symbolic for what the Bible refers to as the cosmos, that is, the world system. The world system is a system of values that is extended all the way from the beginning of human history all the way into the future and the end of history. So when it says that Babylon is going to be destroyed, it's saying that that world system is going to be destroyed. The world system is going away forever. Makes a certain amount of sense. How is it that we could have this entity, Babylon, spanning thousands of years, all the way back to the Egyptians, all the way forward into the reunification of the Roman Empire? That doesn't make much sense. How is it that this entity could be guilty for killing all of the saints and the prophets down throughout history? That's not referring to a single time and place. That's referring to an entire long span of time. That would fit with the world system that persecutes, kills, chews people up. Or is it my most recent revelation that it's both and? That there is a literal city. Is it in Babylon, in modern-day Iraq? I don't know. Okay, I don't know. But is there a literal city out of which the Antichrist rules? It's called a city multiple times in this text. And is it that that city stands for and symbolizes the world system in the same way that we would refer to Wall Street or we would refer to Washington, not just refer to that locale? But Wall Street means symbolically all of the stock market, and Washington stands for all of the United States of America, or Moscow, all of Russia. So while it doesn't mean that Washington, the capital, is a symbol, it's symbolic. Get it? So there's a city, kind of like an epicenter, that when that city falls, the world system falls with it. That's my view. Now, last time I taught this, 10 years ago, I said that was a fundamentalist, crazy view. So now I'm holding that view. So we'll see what happens in 10 years when I teach this again, where I land on it. That's where I'm landing. Anyways, why does John use this term Babylon at all? Why has he used this symbol for this final world system? Well, if you're a Bible reader, you know that Babylon goes all the way back to the beginning of the Bible, back to Babel, the Tower of Babel, Babel. This is in Genesis 11. This is very, very early in human history. And there's a one-world government in the Tower of Babel. God told the people to break loose and multiply and conquer the earth, and they said, no, we're all going to come together and speak the same language. And God wanted each person to be royalty, and they said, no, we've got this guy, Nimrod, don't let the name fool you. This guy is really, really tough. His name in Hebrew, Nimrod, means we shall rebel. That's the guy's name. He's walking around with a name. What's your name? We shall rebel. It's like, whoa, what's this guy like? Well, he's called a mighty warrior, a mighty tyrant in the Hebrew. It doesn't come through in our English very well. That word, gibor, means mighty, tyrant. It says that he's before the Lord. What does that mean? Bruce Waltke says, even in God's estimation, Nimrod is a mighty warrior. Ooh, that tells you something right there. If even God Almighty looks at you and says, that guy is pretty tough. Nimrod running this whole thing, that was pretty bad. So you got, in the very beginning of the human story, everyone coming together, to form some kind of a one-world empire with one guy at the center. It doesn't work. Falls apart. God beats it down. Then later, we flash forward to the Babylonian Empire. I don't mean the old Babylonian Empire going back to the 19th century BC. The new Babylonian Empire was really, really aggressive. Took over the known world. Took over everybody. And it was led by one man, Nebuchadnezzar. He came stomping through the ancient world, took over the ancient world, including Israel. So Babel, failure. Babylon, they were taken over by the Persians. Failure. But now here we've got this Babylon at the end of history, a final world system. In defiance of God, rebelling against God, trying to get everyone to come together to revolt against God, it's no wonder that John is using that term to be able to draw this imagery for his readers and for us today. The world system, this is something, if you're a Bible reader, it's just all over the Bible. It's all over the New Testament. Jesus taught it. The apostles taught it. The word cosmos, maybe you recognize that word, in the sense of cosmetic. You need cosmetics. Why? Because you want to be beautified through decoration. Or the word can mean orderliness, an orderly arrangement. Cosmeo could mean to have things ordered in a certain way. Homeric Greek uses this word in the sense of rowers on a ship, orderly. Or it can just mean cosmos, like cosmology, study of the universe. The sum total of everything, the world, the universe, everything. So a world, beautiful, orderly system. Or in short, a world system. Colin Brown, who is an expert in Greek, editor of this book, New International Dictionary of the New Testament Theology, writes this, quote, "In Greek philosophy, cosmos, this word, is the basic term for the world order, the world system, the sum total of all things preserved by this ordering." So the world system is there to create somewhat of a system created according to the Bible by none other than Satan himself. He is the mind behind a system. You don't just have systems. You don't just have designs. You have designers. And Satan is behind this entire system. What does it do? Well, same author, in his letters, 1 John chapter 2, verse 16, he says, all that is in the cosmos, the world system, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life is not from the Father, but is from the world. Now, lust of the flesh refers to an over-desire for pleasure. Flesh, sarx in Greek, means your fleshly nature. Your desires, your pleasures. And lust is the Greek term epithumia. Epipen, you know, epi meaning over, and thumia meaning passion, desire. Lust, epithumia, what's that mean? Over desire. It's not just that you like wine. It's that you really like wine. You know what I mean? Like you're like, oh, you got an epithumia for wine, right? It's not just that you like your job. It's that you're just like, you're into your job. You know, you got an epithumia. It's an inordinate desire. It's not in order. It's not like God, family, friends, and then you know, you fit the other things into the, right? That's an epithumia. It's out of order. It's inordinate, okay? So pleasure is good, created by God for us. But when it's an epithumia, and you've met these people that are so into pleasure, that you look at their lives and you're like, you're ruining your life. If only you could have this in order, in the right order, you could actually enjoy the pleasure. The lust of the eyes, number two, is the desire for possessions, the things that you can see. And then finally, the boastful pride of life is a desire, over-desire, epithumia, for prestige. So when John refers to this idea of the world system, he's referring to an over-desire for pleasure, possessions, and prestige. So, that's Babylon. Babylon the Great. this terrible system may be located in some city, but definitely throughout history, run by the Antichrist, run by the devil. And it's basically there to coax people away from God, to lure them away into things which are temporal, transitory. They're going to go away very soon. Away from things which are eternal. If Satan could just get you away from eternal things and into things which are temporary and doomed to die, he'd be very happy to distract you in that way. Well, we read in verse 15, "Then the angel said to me, 'The waters you saw where the prostitute sits, these are the peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages.'" So she's reigning over all the people on earth. "The beast and the 10 horns you saw will hate the prostitute." Whoa, that took a quick 90-degree turn, didn't it? I thought they were in this like love fest where she's like riding on top of the beast and he's on top of the nations and they're all loving each other and intoxicated by her stuff and whatever, and they're all together. And now immediately they just like, they hate this prostitute. What do they do to her? They bring her to ruin and leave her naked. They eat her flesh and burn her with fire. That is a bad breakup right there, okay? That's pretty bad. Like, we are definitely not getting back together. Taylor Swift could write a good song about that. Clear, I think she has. Never, ever, ever getting back together. We. That just came to me. That's the one song I know, and it was there. It was in there. Anyways, this is symbolic language. Obviously, it's not that they're cannibalizing a woman, but the system is going to be destroyed by the Antichrist, the kings of the earth. When you read Bible prophecy, you reach a point where you see the Antichrist just says, "It's over, kill them all. It's done." And he starts turning against others. This is why Jesus needs to interfere and intervene right at the last moment. Otherwise, no life on earth would have been saved. Leon Morris is pretty insightful here. He says, "There is no cohesion in evil. It is always self-destructive." Very good point. Why would evil turn against evil? His point here is that evil, that's the way it works. Everyone's out for self. You're out for number one, greedy. And so when the world system stops working for you, you turn on it. You get violent. "The woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth." Chapter 18. "After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven. He had great authority, and the earth was illumined by his splendor. With a mighty voice, he shouted, 'Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a dwelling for demons and a haunt for every evil spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, a haunt for every unclean and detestable animal.'" If this is Satan's system, apparently all the demons and unclean things on earth are going to cram into this one area. "For all the nations have drunk the maddening wine of her adulteries. The kings of the earth committed adultery with her, and the merchants of the earth grew rich from her excessive luxuries. Then I heard another voice from heaven say this, 'Come out of her, my people, so that you will not share in her sins, so that you will not receive any of her plagues.'" It's going down. Coming in, I'm going to judge this system. Get out. "For her sins are piled up to heaven," an allusion to the Tower of Babel, "and God has remembered her crimes. Give back to her as she has given. Pay her back double for what she has done. Pour her a double portion from her own cup. Give her as much torment and grief as the glory and luxury she gave herself." Oh man, this is retributive justice. We're going to see more on this in the future. However, suffice to say, at this point, the world system basically killed, ruined people's lives, just as she gave out torment and grief to all these people. Remember that refrain in Revelation 6, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, will you refrain from judging the earth?" It's over. It's over. God's coming in and saying, "It's done." "In her heart, she boasts, 'I sit enthroned as a queen I am not a widow. I will never mourn. Totally deceived. Right on the precipice of death, you're about to go down forever. Right there is right when this world system is saying that she's a queen. Actually, you're not a queen. You're a prostitute. You think you're going to live on forever. You're never going to mourn. Actually, you're about to face torment and mourning. How could she not see this? I know it's symbolism. I know it's not a literal girl, a literal woman. It's symbolic for a city, a system. But how could they not see it? It's coming at you 1,000 miles an hour, oblivion. Everything you've done, it's all over. It's coming really soon. It's going to be over. There it is, and right to the bitter end. Can't see it. In one day, her plagues will overtake her, death, mourning, and famine. She will be consumed by fire, for mighty is the Lord God who judges her. It's going to be instantaneous. In one day, it's all over. So this whole promise that you're going to be rich and wealthy, things are going to be really gush and wonderful, and then in one day, boom, gone. It's all gone forever, instantaneously. When the kings of the earth who committed adultery with her and shared her luxury see the smoke of her burning, they will weep. They will mourn over her. Terrified, they'll stand far off and cry, whoa. In Greek, this is an onomatopoeia. Ooi, ooi, woe, woe to you, great city, you mighty city of Babylon. In 1 hour, your doom has come. Weeping, mourning, terrified, crying out in woe, just abject mourning, trauma. They're looking out at this world system that's falling apart, just going, how? How did this happen? How did it all go away? How did they not see this coming? The merchants of the earth, they're going to weep. They're weeping too. They're going to mourn over her because nobody buys their cargoes anymore. Cargoes of gold, silver, precious stones and pearls. You see, these are all luxury items. It's not like water and, you know, rice and beans and stuff like that. This is all the stuff that like the rich people would get. Fine linen, purple, silk, scarlet cloth, every sort of citron wood and articles of every kind made of ivory, costly wood, bronze, iron, marble, cargoes of cinnamon and spice, of incense, myrrh, frankincense, wine, olive oil, fine flour, wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and carriages, and human beings sold as slaves. Wow. So apparently the world system is not that harmless, innocuous after all, is it? Oh, we're just getting a little fine jewelry, a little cinnamon, spice, and then, hey, you want a slave with that? We got slaves. No one's going to be buying the slaves anymore. Literally, it's human souls and bodies. Human souls and bodies are being used as chattel in the same way that you would sell olive oil, flour, cattle, sheep. They were selling human beings. The fruit you long for is gone from you, and all things that were luxurious and splendid have passed away from you, and men will no longer find them. The merchants who sold these things and gained their wealth from her will stand far off, terrified at her torment. Again, they're going to be weeping and mourning and crying out, looking at all the money that could be made. It was all there, all that money that could be made. And they're just, the tears are falling down their face. They're weeping, mourning, screaming, crying out. Oh, it's all gone. Whoa! Woe to you, great city, dressed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, glittering with gold, precious stones and pearls. In 1 hour, such great wealth has been brought to ruin. Remember, it was one day? Now it's being intensified in 1 hour. Boom, that fast, it's all gone. The stock market crashes. The system is gone for good, forever. The sea captains, every one of them, all who travel by ship, the sailors, all who earn their living from the sea, they're going to stand far off. When they see the smoke of her burning, they will exclaim, was there ever a city like this great city? You ever have that friend who gets out of that destructive relationship and they know, you know, they know, like, she's not good. She's not good for them. She's destructive. She's dysfunctional. She's got problems. And yet they still have that thing in their heart where it's just like, oh, if I could just get back with her. Same thing here. Even as the world system is on fire, these people are going, was there ever a city like that? They're going to throw dust on their heads and with weeping and mourning cry out, woe, woe to you, great city, where all who had ships on the sea became rich through her wealth. In 1 hour, she had been brought to ruin. Couldn't they see this coming? Couldn't they see it coming? I mean, you can't just go on and on like this forever. Selling, trading, buying, getting richer and richer and richer and greedier and greedier and greedier and amassing more and more toys for yourself. It's just for you. Eventually, you gotta have the wherewithal, the common sense. Anyone can see this. This is not some kind of like a deeply academic exercise. That you see, this cannot go on forever. There's going to be an end point to all this where there's not going to be any more money to be made. Whether it's the end of the world, as we're reading about here, or it's the end of your life, where you leave it all behind, it's just all going to be left behind. Can't you see that coming? Couldn't they see it coming? Well, heaven has a different perspective. On earth, they're weeping, crying, mourning. Heaven, rejoice over her, you heavens. Rejoice, you people of God. Rejoice, apostles and prophets, for God has judged her with the judgment she imposed on you. Then a mighty angel picked up a boulder the size of a large millstone and threw it into the sea and said, with such violence, the great city of Babylon will be thrown down, never to be found again. The music of harpists and musicians, pipers, trumpeteers, will never be heard in you again. No worker of any trade will ever be found in you again. The sound of a millstone will never be heard in you again. The light of a lamp will never shine in you again. The voice of a bridegroom and a bride, they'll never be heard in you again. Your merchants were the world's important people. By your magic spell, all the nations were led astray. Did you notice what I noticed? Almost everything in that list was good. Music, millstones, you know, carpentry or agriculture, marriage, bridegroom, bride, all that stuff, he's saying it's all going away. Why? Why is it going away? Not because those things are bad, but because the world system turned them into something that lured people away from God. Just like the slavery, just like the wealth and decadence, even music, even work, even marriage can draw people away from God. See it happen all the time. So the world system is using good things to lure people from God. In her, we conclude, was found the blood of prophets and of God's holy people, of all who have been slaughtered on the earth. Well, what did we just read? Let's see if we can bring this together. What did we just learn about this world system? For one, it's designed to lure people from God by replacing God, giving you something really shiny, interesting, so that you get into that rather than into God. Get distracted with any good thing. Money, sex, alcohol, work, anything. Anything that's good that God made, that's all good, but it actually replaces God in your mind, in your heart, in your life. We saw that the world system traffics in luxury, greed, and even outright evil. So, yeah, spices, pearls, metals, humans. Like, the world system has no basement. There's no point that it won't go to. It might seem interesting on the thin veneer, the skin, it looks good, but the deeper you go, the sicker and the weirder it gets. Finally, where is the world system headed? Nowhere. It's going toward death. Everything that we just described is going to end. Yeah. So why shouldn't we invest in this? Three reasons. Number one, pleasure, possessions, and prestige all have one thing in common, don't they? They're all going away forever. Forever. your stuff, the stuff you own, that's going away. Your pleasures in your life that you're having, those are going away. Your prestige, all those little acronyms after your name, those little letters, that's going away. Forever. It's all going away. Forever. That's one thing that all the things in the world system have in common. They're temporary. So you get to hold them for a little bit, but then you got to give them right back, and it's over. I remember I was working on a term paper right before I finished my undergraduate work. It was for a class that I hated and a teacher I hated and a paper I hated. And I finished the paper, 10-page paper, which at the time was a lot to me to write. Finished the paper, and right then my computer did this thing to me. It did this. Do you know what they call this? Blue screen of death. That's right. The blue screen of death. And I'm like, no. This happens to other people, not to me. This happens to other people, not to me. I need to graduate, and I need to get this stupid paper into my teacher to finish this stupid degree at this stupid university in this stupid city with these stupid people looking at me. And there it was, man. It was dead. I was in the library. It was dead. My computer was dead. And then I was like, all right, I'll just turn it off and turn it back on. And I tried that. That didn't help. Shutting down permanently. That computer never turned back on. I can't explain to you the nauseating feeling in my gut. I spent hours on that stupid paper. I had to redo all that work right down the toilet. Do you see where I'm going with this? Every single human being on planet Earth one day is going to look at all of the work that they've ever done, and they're going to have precisely the same feeling. You will never look at the blue screen of death the same way, will you? You're going to think in the future, everything I've ever done, every person I've ever impacted, every job I've ever held, every amount of money I've ever saved, my stocks, my bonds, my investments, all of it goes down the blue screen of death. It ends forever. My degrees, my accomplishments, my house, my cars, all of it goes away forever, forever. What about beauty? What about some of you, you're hot, okay? You know it. It's going away, man. It's going away. Look at Clint Eastwood when he was a young man. Look at that guy. Ah, Devin, I don't really know what a good-looking guy looks like, but I think that's what he would look like right there. I think a good-looking guy should be pale, bug-eyed, and kind of tall. But Clint Eastwood, I know he's a good-looking guy. Today, ooh. Old. He got old. Mickey Rourke, man, back in the 80s. That guy, man. Guys wanted to be him. Women wanted to be with him. Today, they left him in the microwave too long. I couldn't get it out. Sorry. Bob Gunton. You guys ever seen Shawshank Redemption? You know, the warden? He redid that scene up here in Ohio. By us, Ohio. We're in Ohio. He redid that scene recently. That's him today. Old. Jack Nicholson. Yeah, he's a good-looking guy. Great eyebrows. Today? Did you miss it? I just wanted to... Okay, you did see it. Okay. All right, when you know this, when you know that your whole life is going away forever, your possessions, your pleasure, your prestige, it's all going away, your good looks, everything you've ever done, it's all going away, it becomes pretty difficult to enjoy life. Because you know all the things that are giving me pleasure and status and everything, if these things go down and this is my identity, that means my identity just went down. And if these things go up and that's my identity, then my identity just went up. But if these things are all going to the trash heap, what does that make me? I like this dark satire, Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, Steve Carell, where it talks about how there's an asteroid coming to Earth within hours, and all of the frivolous things that people do right before the asteroid. Yeah, let's see what you think.
The final mission to save mankind has failed. The 70-mile-wide asteroid, known commonly as Matilda, is set to collide with Earth in exactly 3 weeks' time, and we'll be bringing you up-to-the-minute coverage of our countdown to the end of days, along with all your classic rock favorites. This is Q107.2.
We'll be bringing you all the information you need, as long as we have a live feed. And be sure to stay tuned at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
I thought I'd let you all know of a few positions in upper management that have been made available. So, if anyone wants to be Chief Financial Officer, CFO, anyone?
Life has no meaning.
Anyone?
Okay, well, I think I'm finally going to take that pottery class. And, well, I'm going to eat whatever I want and totally not even care.
Go, girl.
Hi, welcome to Frenzies, where everyone's your friend.
This is the fucking Ark, Diane. This is the Titanic. And there is not a life raft in sight. Welcome aboard.
Good movie. Basically, the message is existentialism. What's the meaning? There is no meaning, except that we found each other and we exist for this moment and we love each other. Whatever. Give me a break. So, here's some of the actual data on this. Here's Ed Diner. He's a professor of psychology out of the University of Illinois. In his book on happiness, he says, people who try to make themselves really happy, those folks who chase excitement in relationships, a big paycheck at work, and intense thrills in their leisure time, are a bit like rats on a treadmill, running and running, but not really getting anywhere. The literature refers to this as the hedonic treadmill, that the more you run, you eventually reach a state of stasis. You run a little bit further, but then it brings you right back to where you were. You're not really moving anywhere with regard to your happiness. The pleasure paradox, you can go and bounce up and down a little bit when you get a raise or you have sex, you get drunk, whatever. You bounce up a little bit, but then you come right back to where you were, maybe even lower. So let's think about this for a second. The hedonic treadmill, this tendency of humans to return to a relatively stable level of happiness despite positive or negative events. You go right back to where you were. Let's think about this. Are you happier now that you can check your phone every 10 minutes? Does it make you happier? There's 1,440 minutes in the day, and on average, the average American checks their phone 144 times per day. That's once every 10 minutes without sleep. Without sleep. So it's more. It's more. 6 minutes, 7 minutes a day, every 6, 7 minutes. Does that make you happier? Does it make you happier now that you can watch a screen for 7 hours a day? That's the average, by the way. Does it make you happier? Does it make you happier now that you're omniscient? Of course, I'm speaking with my tongue in my cheek. We're not actually all-knowing. But now that we can look at everyone's, gossip online and look all around the world and see all the problems, does that really bring a lot more happiness into your life? Does sexual habituation and compulsion make you feel better? Or does it just make you feel less? Like when you get into some kind of a sexual hookup, porno, whatever. Of course your dopamine spikes. You feel better. Yeah, you feel better. Or is it that you're just trying to feel less of how you normally feel? And can you tell the difference? That's a real problem when you get to the point in addiction, whether it's drugs, drinking, sex, spending sprees, anything, where you can't tell the difference between feeling happy and just not feeling sad anymore? How many minutes does it take before you return right back to normal? You know, right after you get into one of these falls, how long is it before you're right back to where you were, right before you had a fall? How long does it take for happiness to wear off after you buy something new? You get that thing on Amazon, click, 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 boom, and then you get it. Makes you feel happy, obviously. Otherwise, you wouldn't do it. How long does it take before it wears off? A couple hours? A couple days? A couple weeks? Not a couple months, sorry. No, it's not that long. You buy something and then it's gone. It's fleeting, very fleeting. Very hard to enjoy this stuff, knowing the pleasures, the possessions, the prestige is all going away forever. However, the reason we shouldn't invest in this God-forsaken system is because investing in God and in people is the only thing that lasts for eternity. The only thing. It's the only thing getting out of this world. You know, if God could light a match and burn up the entire material universe but rescue one soul, he would do it. Because a single soul is worth more than everything else put together. So when you invest in God and when you invest in people made in his image, this is what brings you true happiness. As John writes, all that is in the world, lust of the flesh, eyes, boastful pride of life, it's not from God. That's not from him. That's from the world, those over desires. The world that's passing away, and also those over desires. But the one who does the will of God lives forever. Here is the solution. When we feel that vacancy in our heart, our soul, what's going to bring me happiness? What's going to bring me a meaning to life? This right here. Knowing, not hoping, knowing that this is going to go on forever and we're going to be with God forever. So any impact that we could make, any work we could do for that day when instead of facing the blue screen of death, so to speak, we face our Creator and we hear those incredible words, "Well done, good and faithful servant, come into the joy of your master." Yeah, that's something to live for. When you get out of bed in the morning, waking up thinking, what's on my mind? What's my purpose? What's my meaning? Living for a gizmo? Living for a gadget? Come on, we got to do better. You know you were made for something better than that. This is what it is, to know God and to love people. And when you get into this, you can face the end of the world when everything else is crashing down and everyone else is crying and screaming and moaning. You can be rejoicing knowing it's finally here. I'm finally here with God.